These days, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make all kinds of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more, right here in the USA. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs in towns and cities across the country. And jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.
She was, that beautiful little baby girl was the joy of both mind and love, life. What's wrong with Brittany? What's wrong? I don't know. She stopped breathing. And next thing you know, she just started breathing real rapidly. She just continued to breathe even faster and until she just stopped breathing.
Blood tests that did not show evidence of scurvy just weeks before she died. And I was walking around here for a while using my my pirate voice, complaining about scurvy.
Yeah, I'm going home. I'm really going home.
I'm a father of three. I'm sorry, this just doesn't add up to me.
I found it ridiculous, personally, but a lot of the arguments they make are ridiculous, I think.
Scurvy, once the plague of pirates and seafaring explorers, became the unique, almost impossible to believe defense for a Nevada man accused of killing the 11-month-old daughter of his girlfriend. The story begins in 1988, when a 19-year-old Charles Robbins was living with his girlfriend and her 11-month-old daughter, Brittany McDowell. The child and her mother had recently moved to Las Vegas from Springfield, Illinois. Robbins now goes by the name Hakeem Sharif, but has not legally changed his name. While Brittany was not biologically his, Robbins said he considered himself her father.
She was, that beautiful little baby girl was the joy of both mind and love life. I mean, she was happy. She was always smiling. She had the most beautiful smile you could definitely see. And, I mean, love. I mean, with Brittany, she would love to be picked up, but then she'd get fussy and want to be put down. And then if you weren't paying attention to her, she'd get on the edge of the bed and start rocking because she wanted you to pay attention to her and pick her up. And a couple of times she ended up falling off the edge of the bed. So those are things that we ended up having to be careful of and be mindful that she had those behaviors. But yeah, she would constantly wake me up and in the morning, crawl on top of her daddy and get in my face and wake me up and rock herself on top of me like, "Wake up, daddy." So, yeah, that was my little angel.
The courtroom testimony painted a different picture of his interactions with Brittany. Here is how a 1990 Nevada Supreme Court opinion described the interactions based on courtroom testimony. He often held his hand over her mouth and nose until she gasped for breath. On several occasions, Robbins held Brittany underwater in the bathtub until she came up gasping for breath. One witness observed an occasion when Robbins caused the infant to turn blue from lack of breath. Robbins frequently shut Brittany in a dark bathroom for several hours at a time. Once he was seen holding the infant over a second-floor railing by her neck and shaking her. Other incidents of abuse by Robbins included putting Brittany on the top shelf of a closet some 6 feet above the floor, closing the door, and letting her fall to the floor. Robbins would also force his finger down Brittany's throat and cause her to gag. One witness testified that Robbins frequently repeated this abuse until the child could no longer gag and ceased crying. Robbins has denied ever abusing Brittany. Tragedy struck on April 19, 1988.
The day that my daughter died, earlier during that night, of course, my son's mother, Love, and I had a romantic interlude with each other, and I ended up going to sleep. Was awakened several hours later by a phone call from a guy by the name of John Tarver, who was complaining about the police having stopped him and confiscated his moped, which he was driving without any registration. And at the conclusion of that phone call, we were called and ordered a pizza. And while we were waiting for the pizza, I went in and checked on Brittany. I had a ritual where I would try to keep her up a little later so she wouldn't wake up as early in the morning and wake us up. So after I checked in on her, the pizza got there, got a slice, then went and checked on her and just basically sat side by side her and kind of like put the tips of my fingers on her face and kind of shook her from side to side. She woke up crying a little bit, then like propped myself up on my elbow, but kind of laying across her, but not with any body weight. I was propped up on my elbow and she was underneath me. And she was playing with my fingers and on the soapbox. Then I got up, I kissed her on the forehead. And as I was heading towards the direction of the door, she coughed a couple of times. I looked back and next thing you know, she just started breathing real rapidly. And I looked back and immediately went to her and Brittany, you all right? What's wrong, baby? Yep, and picked her up and she just continued to breathe even faster and even faster and until she just stopped breathing. And I reacted by shaking her, yelling her name, and then ran towards the bathroom. Love met me as I was, crossing the hallway into the bathroom. What's wrong with Brittany? I don't know. She stopped breathing. She started going in a panic, and I put her head on the basin of the sink and started splashing water on her. She still wouldn't wake up, so I took her back to the bedroom, tried to administer CPR, had no idea what I was doing. I messed that up to such an extent that when a Sergeant McCormick from the Air Force, who lived in an apartment not directly above us, but above us, but across the hall from us, came down upon hearing Love screaming and acting manically, running throughout the apartment complex. He just started doing CPR compressions, saw that I was doing this all wrong, that her stomach had filled up with air. He just started telling me to start applying light pressure on her stomach to expel the air. And then he started doing CPR, and next thing you know, the room just filled up with a bunch of people. I heard some other people singing like they were chanting something. And not too long after that, the paramedics arrived on the scene and they transported both Brittany and Love to the hospital. And I was left behind to talk to the police. I explained to them exactly what happened and what I did.
The paramedics rushed Brittany to the hospital, where measures were taken to restore breathing and a heartbeat. The infant could not be revived, however, and was pronounced dead shortly after her arrival. A medical examiner's autopsy investigation revealed a number of injuries. The external exam revealed bruises under Brittany's jaw, bruises on the upper portion of her sternum, and a number of bruises on her back. Additionally, there was a small hemorrhage in the left flank. The internal examination showed multiple hemorrhages on the scalp on the left side and top of the head, and there were bilateral subdural hemorrhages. The brain was swollen, a direct response to injury. Further internal examination of the abdominal and thoracic cavities revealed additional injuries. there were a number of hemorrhages in the mesentery, supporting connective tissue of the intestines. Additionally, there was substantial internal scarring on the left side below the kidney. The scar tissue encased the ureter and extended from the kidney down to the large intestine. The medical examiner noted that Brittany's right femur showed signs of having been broken in the past. She had to reference Brittany's medical records to ascertain that the leg had been broken twice and was in the process of healing. During the 1989 trial, a jury heard this evidence, found Charles Robbins guilty of capital murder, and sentenced him to death. He remained on Nevada's death row for 29 years, awaiting execution when his lawyer presented a novel defense. Brittany wasn't abused. She had scurvy. Scurvy is a disease caused by a diet lacking vitamin C. It has all been but eradicated in the developed world. But two physicians hired by the defense more than a quarter of a century after her death said after examining her x-rays that Brittany may have suffered from scurvy. Most Americans only know about scurvy from history books and popular culture. In an episode of SpongeBob SquarePants, they sang the scurvy song.
Our gums are black, our teeth are falling out. We got spots on our back, so give it up and shout. We got scurvy, we need some vitamin C. We got scurvy, we need a lemon tree. We got scurvy, we just chillin' on the sea.
The scurvy defense left Clark County District Attorney Stephen Owens unimpressed.
Yes, and I was walking around here for a while using my pirate voice, complaining about scurvy. It was it kind of reflects the absurdity of the minutia and the things that are alleged, and how we have to defend against some of these claims that this girl was suffering from some disease that was largely eradicated once we discovered citrus and vitamin C and vitamin D can fix these sorts of things. And this child was seen by emergency doctors while she was alive, had a stint in the hospital and was cared for and had blood tests that did not show evidence of scurvy just weeks before she died. And yet here, 20, 30 years after the fact, they're claiming that the coroner and all the hospital people and all the nurses, everyone that saw all this child abuse, they all missed the scurvy. Yeah, I found it ridiculous. Personally, but a lot of the arguments they make are ridiculous, I think.
But one group of people who apparently didn't find the argument ridiculous was the justices on the Nevada Supreme Court.
That's what he argued. That was not resolved in court. The parties agreed to, rather than to litigate those claims, which we opposed, I filed a lengthy response challenging that and showing how he was not actually innocent. And rather than submit that question to a judge and have an evidentiary hearing, both parties decided it was in their best interest to not resolve that issue and instead resolve the case with the negotiation that we did do. That resulted at this 30-year sentence. I think actually 25 years was imposed, but I think he spent more than that in prison. There was also a child abuse and neglect charge that he did like 10 years for, I think.
I guess, but the $100 million question is, do you think he's innocent or do you think he's guilty?
Prosecutors cannot proceed with the case, and I cannot defend a conviction if I have an honest belief that somebody has been wrongfully convicted. This never has struck me as a situation where he was wrongfully convicted. They all claim that they're innocent. They all file claims just like this, claiming new evidence. That's what we do here. And all these habeas and all these appeals that go on for 20, 30 years after they're convicted, it takes much longer. Much more money is spent on the back end trying to defend against some of these claims for many, many years than was ever spent obtaining the conviction and the death sentence in the first place. We spend a lot of resources, the defense does. I go to court and there's one of me and there's eight of them. all arguing these cases, and it's very difficult 20, 30 years to get to any kind of resolution of the truth. That's a silly system that thinks we're going to conclusively establish somebody's innocence 20, 30 years after the fact, except maybe in a few rare DNA cases, after the passage of time, we get further from the truth, not closer to it. And so these types of claims, yeah, he claims he's innocent and claims he has new evidence. Those are quite common. We deal those all the time. No, I did not find those to be persuasive at all.
High Court ruled that there should be an evidentiary hearing to investigate the possibility that Brittany's death was related to scurvy. The hearing never happened, but it became the impetus for defense and prosecution to negotiate a deal for Charles Robbins' release. But the scurvy defense raises other questions. One question it raises is, if Brittany was indeed malnourished, why wasn't she receiving the balanced diet she needed?
One other question that came to mind when I read this about the scurvy argument, well, that's a nutritional issue. Isn't that neglect if she got scurvy?
I made that argument too, that making that argument, all that would do is infuriate the jury, because now you're admitting that she's weak and more susceptible to injury because you have malnourished her. that goes right into the child abuse and neglect theory that we had here for causing her death, whether it was by him physically beating her and or by malnourishing her and making her more susceptible to dying from those blows, whereas another child might have survived and not have died. I don't see how that gets him any sympathy from a jury. Again, I did not, you're right, I didn't find the scurvy argument to be persuasive or valid at all, but the Supreme Court ordered an evidentiary hearing on that, and the defense had some experts who were prepared to come in and testify that she did in fact have scurvy, and those experts would testify that it would have made a difference here. So we'll never know. We decided not to litigate that issue, and because we could get the conviction for murder and 30 years out of it, which is what we did.
But there are real questions of how a jury would have received the scurvy defense.
Supposedly their final offer, which was, I don't have to admit to anything, I don't have to take a plea, I'll just waive my appeals, and they will amend the sentence to a murder two, and then I'm released. And, of course, I was unhappy with that decision. Still, I'm unhappy with it because it felt like I was giving up the fight, and they weren't being held accountable for what they were doing and what they had done. So I wrestled with that for a while, but it was pretty much at that time when it just really hit me that, yeah, I'm going home. I'm really going home, whether it's immediately after agreeing to these terms or even 5 to 7 years down the line, if I can decide to continue to fight it. And even if this court rules in my favor, I knew they were going to appeal it, and it's going to be dragged out another 5 to 7 years through the appeal process before it came to any type of resolution. So, but even, like I said, even so, it's like, yeah, it's pretty much written that I'm going home. And, I mean, the anticipation of what I'm coming home to.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I'm always looking for something healthy to eat. And the problem is, I don't always eat healthy. If it was left up to me, I'd be sitting in front of the TV eating corn chips. And that's because I don't plan very well. And it's an effort to go out and to store and hunt down healthy things to eat. But hey, you can get healthy things delivered to your home to dine on. And these aren't meals. These are just snacks. Healthy snack food. What a concept. The company I'm talking about is Hungry Root. They were founded back in 2015. Hungry Root is a brand of healthy comfort food. They take foods that people associate with indulgence and lack of health and reinvent them using vegetables and other wholesome ingredients. And they'll deliver them to your house every week. Think of them as the healthy convenience food company. They deliver weekly boxes of foods that customers can use to make a variety of inspiring, delicious dishes. All their food is plant-based and gluten-free. Their meals come either ready to eat or ready in less than 10 minutes. Customers can choose to make the dishes according to the recipes that are provided or mix and match ingredients for additional flexibility. They offer over 75 dishes that customers can make at home, like sweet potato pad thai made from sweet potato noodles, spicy peanut sauce, and snap peas. I'm just saying, that is just absolutely delicious. And then there's the almond chip pea cookie dough. I can't wait to serve this up for my three daughters. They love ice cream. And the idea that I could fool them and get them to eat something healthy that they're also going to think is indulgent, I just think is so awesome. And you can even eat it straight from the container, folks. There are no commitments to working with Hungry Root. You can skip a weekly box when you don't need it. And folks, there are just so many people out there that love it. It's gotten a 4.6 Facebook rating. You can't do much better than that. It is just exceptionally popular. And guess what? Because you're listening to Suspect Convictions, you can save $25 off on your first two orders, a $50 saving, by using the code SUSPECT at checkout. To get started, go to hungryroot.com. That's $25 each of the first two orders using SUSPECT at checkout. Once again, folks, go to hungryroot.com and enter the code SUSPECT to get $25 off on your first two orders. I'm just saying, go for it. You're going to enjoy this food. It's really good. This is Scott Reeder, founder of Suspect Convictions. I should note that Harim Sharif, also known as Charles Robbins, has said that during the police interrogation of his former girlfriend, she made assertions about him that were not true. We haven't been able to reach the former girlfriend to hear her side of the story. But it's certainly something worth discussing during this episode. I'm joined today by Michelle Ben-Simon, who is our narrator. So, what did you think of this case? I mean, what stood out to you about it, Michelle?
Well, a few things I'd say stood out. So the assumption that this was murder without full medical evidence and full medical assessments. And also, again, his partner being forced to say something that is absolutely not true. And again, that corruption in the police force to force her to say that this could have been possible when it was so clearly not possible, and threatening her and her family and to take her kids away.
Yeah. And, you know, this isn't the first time I've come across a case where there was an allegation like that made. I remember in my hometown, a small town in Galesburg, there was a guy who was falsely convicted of a bank robbery. The reason he got convicted is he looked just like the bank robber. And the police took his wife and sat her down and said, if you don't say it's him, we're going to take your kids away from you. And she just was desperate. And she said, yes, it was him. He ends up in jail. And by some luck, the state representative that represents Galesburg was in a motel room here in Springfield for a legislative session, and he was watching the local news, and there was something about a bank robbery going on in this area. And when he's watching, he goes, that looks just like the guy I know from church back home. You know, they look just alike. And he knew he'd been arrested for bank robbery. He was in jail, so it couldn't have been him.
Right.
So he came forward with the information, and they end up getting the guy released. But What strikes me about this is interesting is people can be manipulated in those interrogation rooms to say what police want them to say. We've looked at all these wrongful confessions we've looked at over the years. It happens, and it's a little bit perplexing. And I think all of us think to ourselves, well, if I was in that situation, there's no way I would do that. But we don't really know. I mean, it happens. Now,
right.
Having said that, I'm sorry, I just don't buy this argument about scurvy. Anybody who regularly listens to this podcast knows that I very much believe that there are large numbers of innocent people locked up in prison, and that a lot of it happens because of police misconduct and all of those things. But I just think this is the goofiest argument that I've seen a court buy into in a long time. I just don't think this child and had scurvy. You think about that's traditionally a malnourishment issue that affected sailors, who were on the seas for extended periods of time because they didn't
exactly
ingest vitamin C. But you can get vitamin C not just from fruits and vegetables. You can get it from fresh meat. I mean, I'm sorry. It just strikes me as an absolutely preposterous argument. I don't know.
Yeah.
What was your thinking when you read it, Michelle?
I mean, I don't think I've heard many cases of scurvy in the 80s in small children. So I guess I was kind of confused about that. And I was confused because, you know, we also see a lot of police officers wanting to put someone away so that they could kind of find the person who did it and be done with it. That's often what I feel from it. They don't want this to drag on, or maybe they truly believe the person did it. But in this case, if it was a medical thing, then what would be their reasons for wanting to put him away? If it wasn't to just close a case, you know, because they could have gone through all the medical issues, but they obviously truly believed that he did it.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, when I interviewed Haim Sharif, also known as Charles Robbins, one of the things he said is he was a drug dealer, a fairly substantial drug dealer, because he had people working for him. So he was probably on the police radar. The other thing is, you know, my experience is, generally speaking, now our previous episode may have been the out of New Orleans may have been an exception, but generally speaking, I don't think that police officers try to frame innocent people, but sometimes they try to frame guilty people. And if the evidence is a little lacking, maybe they'll use a little bit of coercion or strong persuasion to get somebody to fall in line and tell a story. And that may have very well happened with Haim Sharif's girlfriend. But I'm sorry. I kept looking at this case and, okay, let's say she did have scurvy. That's a malnourishment issue that's caused by a person not having anything that contains vitamin C. It could be, you know, fruits and vegetables or fresh meat and all these different things. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, then what are you arguing? That you and your girlfriend didn't do a very good job of looking after this little girl, and you were malnourishing her? I mean, that's kind of what runs through my mind on it. I mean, and besides that, you take a victim as they are. Let's say she had scurvy, and her bones were very brittle, and all of those things. Well, you know, if he was playing with her, or he kind of downplays what he was doing, but he was kind of laying on her without her full weight, that sort of thing, and her bones were broken. Well, still, I mean, that would strike me as just really inappropriate behavior. I can't quite fathom. I mean, I'm a father of three. I'm sorry. This just doesn't add up to me.
Exactly. I mean, still, you know, malnourishment in a child and a child not having proper care to the point where the child, you know, dies. I mean, that could be, even if it was scurvy and inappropriate behavior on their part, is what is the line? Is that considered, would that be considered murder? Would that be considered, you know, not intentional, but I mean, where is that line?
Exactly. I mean, the more I look at it, I just don't get it. I mean, and it's important to remember, this was not a case handled by an Innocence Project. This was a case that a guy on death row, he served 30-some years. And, you know, when you're on death row, there's just continual, endless appeals. And his attorney, federal public defender, came up with this defense and had people look at this x-rays, you know, and say, well, that could be scurvy. Well, okay. I don't know how you can do a very good medical diagnosis 30 years after the fact, looking at records. Yeah, it also could be, you know, just plain and simple violence against a child. It's pretty hard to place that. The other thing that runs through my mind is, that's why I was talking to the prosecutor, is this child had been to the hospital before. She'd had blood workups, and there was no vitamin C deficiency ever found. So it just seems to me to be a hard case for me to buy into the idea that this 11-month-old baby had a disease that you usually associate with pirates. I mean, it just doesn't add up to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I talked to the prosecutor in the case, he was saying, okay, the Nevada Supreme Court said, well, we need to have a new evidentiary hearing on this. He wasn't granted a new trial, but they wanted to have an evidentiary hearing 30 years after the fact and look at this issue of could it be scurvy. And this is what prompted the defense and the prosecution to start talking to each other and saying, hey, he served 30 years. Is that enough time for a murder conviction? So they basically released him on time served. So, you know, what do you think? Do you think that there was an injustice done here, or what's your thinking?
I feel like I understand what they're saying, how, you know, usually it's like 20, 25, maybe 30 years as a life sentence. But I think it doesn't really matter that he happened to be younger than potentially some people who end up on death row. But I think, I don't know. What is the amount of time that's served that could equate to a young child, you know, dying? I don't know if 30 years, you know, means suddenly that this man could not necessarily do something like that. Maybe not the same thing again, but how do we know that, you know, drugs aren't going to come into play again, and drug dealing and kind of reintegrating back into society when we're not 100% sure that they didn't do it?
Yeah, that's just it. I mean, you never know those things. I just think of that baby. I mean, she died a tragic death no matter what story you buy into. And I just can't help but think what was going on in that home contributed to it, whether it was malnourishment, whether it was violence, whatever it was. I mean, I just don't think anything there really speaks well of what was going on in that home.
And how do you think the mother of the child, like, where does that sort of story live? Do you know where she is, or what?
Good question.
You know, because if it was malnourishment, I think both of them would play a part in that.
That's a good question. I reached out to her. I emailed her, reached out on Facebook. She's not gotten back to me. So
I don't know. I'd love to hear from the mother on this case. I was really startled when I started working on it, and I found out the baby was born in Springfield, Illinois, where I happen to live, which is just, you know, a medium-sized city here, about 100,000 people. But, you know, I've been hunting for the mother, reached out to her. She hasn't gotten back to me. It's just, I don't know. It just strikes me as not a real compelling argument for innocence, actual innocence in this case. And, you know, usually I think when we look at these cases where somebody's been released, I think there is a really compelling argument to be made. I'm just not getting it there. But apparently those judges on the Nevada Supreme Court saw something that I didn't see. I don't know.
Yeah, that's where I wonder what the judges saw, or if they felt like, well, that's enough time served, and so that's okay. I mean, I'm not really sure. I mean, I think if you and I could be talking about it and questioning it, it seems like a judge would be doing the same. And so that is a little bit confusing.
I think so, too.